Welcome to ACMN Conversations. I'm ACMN's Managing Director, Lyndall Pond, and today's guest needs no introduction at all. We are so excited to welcome Australia's greatest theatre impresario and long-standing client of ours, John Frost AM. Frosty, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Look, I'm absolutely thrilled. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. It's always a lot of fun when you have to talk about yourself.
Yes, and our best guests are the ones that do great talking about themselves. So let's jump in. Now, I know you've told this story many times, but your path from props assistant to dresser at Her Majesty's in Adelaide to Tony Award-winning Broadway producer is so inspirational. Do you want to just step us through the highlights of that guy in Adelaide to the heights and lights of Broadway?
Basically it all started from the early days of black and white television when, as a kid, I would watch the old sort of MGM movies on afternoon television, and this is probably in the early 60s. And then when television, our family first got their television probably in early 60s, and that was a big influence also. Things like the Graham Kennedy Show, and then which was in Melbourne Tonight, and then a show called The Mavis Bramston Show, which was a review-type show with wonderful Australian artists such as Carol Rae, Barry Creighton and Gordon Chater and June Salter. That was a big influence on me. And I decided I wanted to be in the industry or in the business, but I didn't think I had the talent to do it. Well, as it worked out, I joined an amateur theatre group called the Mayfair Theatre Company in Adelaide, because I was born in Adelaide and I was still living in Adelaide at the age of probably 12 or 13. And I did one musical called Showboat, where I was in the chorus. And the director at the end of it said, listen, I think from now on you should stay backstage and become an assistant stage manager, because you sing out of tune and your left foot goes where the right should go, sort of thing. So I decided there and then that I was more valuable backstage than on stage. So I then got a job with the famous theatrical company JC Williamson's at Her Majesty's Theatre in Adelaide. And I worked on some shows there as a dresser, one being, one of the first ones was a musical called Maine, which was a Jerry Herman musical. And I was a dresser to all the chorus boys. And that starred an American star called Gay Lee Byrne. And the rest were Australian performers, people like Sheila Bradley, if people remember her, a wonderful performer called Mary Hardy. And I toured with that around Australia as a dresser. And then after that, I got a job at the old Theatre Royal in Sydney before they pulled it down as a wardrobe master for a musical called The Canterbury Tales with an Australian artist called Johnny Lockwood and an actor called Nick Tate, a lady called Alwyn Leckie, Rona McLeod, John Unicum, Michael Caton. I was, they made me dresser to the star, Johnny Lockwood, and wardrobe master. Now, I'd never sewn a button on, let alone how could I qualify as master, but I had sort of possibly good organisation skills. And I did that for 18 months and toured around Australia with that production, which was great fun. I remember very vividly. And when I had to leave to do another show after 18 months, it was very sad. And then I sort of built my way up and I got a job with Harry M. Miller as his office boy, and a man called Ken Brodziak, who brought the Beatles to Australia, as his office boy. And I worked in the management offices of both those companies in Melbourne and during the day, and at night I was an usher on Harry M. Miller's productions of Hair at the Metro Theatre in Melbourne and various other shows. And then I got a job as an assistant stage manager with those shows, and then eventually a stage manager. And then I went on to, what did I do after that? I did, came to Sydney, did that. Then I worked at Channel 9, at TCN Channel 9 in Sydney for a couple of years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, as moving scenery around for their big Tonight shows and Current Affair I worked on and Super Flying Fun Show and goodness knows what there. And then I got a job. They moved me out of the studios into the film library where it was my job to program all the television commercials. So in those days, they were all cassettes. And basically, I had this running order where, you know, let's say the Nine News was going to air, and at 8 minutes past six, there'd be a commercial break, and we had to slot in 3 to 4 commercials. So it was my job, okay, Palmolive soap there. The next one was, say, Colgate toothpaste ad there. So they were all done manually. Now I gather it'd be all computerized, digitized.
You would be amazed at how they do it now.
So that was great. And because they, you know, they had Sunday work, I used to always work on a Sunday, try to, because there was not a lot to do and I'd get double time or triple time or something. And it was great. So I did that for 2 years. Then I went and worked for the Old Tote Theatre Company, which was equivalent to the Sydney Theatre Company. And I was a stage manager there and stage managed shows at the Drama Theatre at the Sydney Opera House and the Parade Theatre. And I did that for, 4 years or something, I think 3 or 4 years. And then they went into bankruptcy, into liquidation, and the Sydney Theatre Company came out of it. So I chose to leave by that stage, but I got to work with wonderful people like Robin Nevin and lots of Ron Hadrick, lots of stars of the non-for-profit theatre at the time, and of course, work at the Opera House. Then I got a job as a stage manager for a show called The Kingfisher, which starred Googie Withers and John McCallum and Frank Thring. And I toured Australia with that for about 12 months. And then after that, I got a job at the Elizabethan Theatre Trust in administration, where my job was to set up all the national tours and also be company manager at the same time, where I set up the national tour of Duke Ellington and his orchestra. I set up the tour of the Dance Theatre of Harlem. I worked with an actor called Louis Jordan and an actress called Leslie Caron, the stars of the movie Gigi, that came to Australia to do a play. So I worked with that and I set up all the tours around the country with that. Oh, that's right, and the Old Vic Theatre Company with Derek Jacobi in Hamlet, which was great doing that. And then I got a job as an agent for Shanahan Management, and I was an agent for a year. Okay. And these were the days, when people like Judy Davis and Mel Gibson had just got out of NIDA, and Mel had just filmed Mad Max. It was before his star exploded, and Judy was just, I think she'd just finished doing, her famous Australian film. I can't recall the name of it now. But I was working with the agent who represented all those people. And I did that for a year. And I basically, at the end of that year, it wasn't a job. I didn't enjoy being an agent. And Bill sacked me, Bill Shanahan. And we left on good terms, but it wasn't for me. And then I got a job running the Marion Street Theatre at Killara for about 3 years and worked with John Crummell, the artistic director there. And they were a great 3 years where I learned a lot of my business skills. And then after that, I went and worked at Kinsella's, and I ran Kinsella's showroom for about 2 years. And for, you know, shows like the Sydney Dance Company played there, the Max Gillies played there. And that was that I enjoyed a lot. And then I met Ashley Gordon, who was a young publicist at the time from Melbourne, and we took out the lease on the Footbridge Theatre in Sydney, which sat 700 people, and we basically had no money at all. I remember the first show we put in was a play called Night Mother, which starred Jewel Perryman and June Salter, and it was about suicide, where this young girl comes home from work and she says to her mother, I'm going to shoot myself in 90 minutes. And the 90-minute play is basically about the mother trying to talk her daughter out of shooting herself. And at the end of the 90 minutes, she goes upstairs and shoots herself. And it was a big, massive hit. And we made a lot of money on that. And I thought, this is easy. Why have I been working with people all these years when I can turn around and make $70,000 basically by doing a play? And they were the days when $70,000 was a lot of money. And we did that. Then we did, straight after that, we did a show called Women Behind Bars, which was a satirical send-up on a women's prison, and it lost $120,000. I thought, this isn't so much fun anymore, but it was probably the best thing that ever happened, because it gave me a respect for the dollar, and that the show business producing theatre is not as easy as it looks. And so from there, we had set up the Gordon Frost organisation, and hence for the next 30 to 40 years during that period, Ashley died about 4 years later. From AIDS, and so I took the company on and kept it going up until the end of last year. It was 30-odd years more, probably 30, nearly 40 years. And we have produced some of the biggest musicals in the country, and probably the most musicals in the country, since the J.C. Williamson organisation was formed. And, you know, the highlights, obviously, of that career were The King and I, Rodgers and Hammerstein's King and I. It opened in Adelaide and toured Australia, and then we formed a new company, and it went to Broadway, where it won the coveted Tony Award, which is equivalent to the Oscar in theatre terms. And so we won three Tony Awards, one for me and one for Roger Kirk, the set designer, and for Brian Thompson, the set designer, Roger Kirk, the costume designer, and American actress called Donna Murphy for her portrayal of Mrs. Anna.
Yeah.
And then that went to London at the London Palladium, and we played 2 years at the London Palladium, breaking the box office record for that, the biggest advance ever at the time for a musical at the London Palladium. So, where it broke box office records, the Palladium ran for 2 years, then another 2 years touring the UK. And the American company ran for about 2.5 years on Broadway, and then did a big 2-year tour throughout America. And then we got involved with a show over there called Hairspray. Mm. And I went to the first workshop called Hairspray, and we invested about $1 million into Hairspray, and became an originating producer. And subsequently that won many Tony Awards, and another one for myself for that, which was nice. And that show still tours the world, and that production, and still returns money back to the original producers, which is great. So that then takes us up probably through my relationships with the Opera Australia, where we recreated The King and I to great success with Lisa McCune, and went on to recreate the 1956 production of My Fair Lady, directed by Julie Andrews, the original Eliza Doolittle.
A highlight of your career and mine.
Yeah, I think out of all of them, you know, there's three shows that really have meant something to me. And I produce hundreds of shows, and would be certainly The King and I, The Secret Garden, which is a major favourite of mine, and, of course, the Julie Andrews production of My Fair Lady, which have been extraordinary. You know, so I suppose that sort of brings us up to now, where I sold the company at the end of last year to Crossroads Live. And we're now a part of a bigger consortium of players, and we have, you know, big chunks of money at our disposal to do whatever shows we feel are appropriate here in Australia and around the world. So life's good.
Sure is. And you know what I love the most about your story is how many roles you took along the way. You've been a dresser, you've been a stage manager, you've had a dabble in the advertising industry, which now makes me nervous, as we're the experts here. But having touched so many roles along your path, it must give you such a sense of knowing and confidence when you're producing a show, because you've been there yourself. I think that's awesome.
And I think you're right. It certainly does, but it doesn't come naturally, because I think as you get older, you become more confident. I certainly can speak for myself that I have, and I find that that even with all that experience years ago, I was still very shy or nervous about speaking out about things. But now it doesn't particularly worry me. I'll just say what that needs to be said and express my feelings. And hopefully the knowledge that I can give to a situation and feel confident about it.
Yeah. Where,
you know, years ago, do that at a younger age.
Yes, and you second guess yourself. In fact, one of the questions I was going to ask you today, and I'm sure confidence is a big part of this, but when you do pick the shows, what you're going to produce, what goes through your mind? I know there is a lot of instinct with you, but what are some of the things that you would look at if you were talking to a young producer today? How do you make those choices?
Yeah, well, look, I think there's a couple of things. There's, like, for instance, when I sat down and I watched 30 actors sitting behind on a stools and lecterns and a script in front of them for the first reading of Hairspray, and I listened to the first act, I knew there and then that that was going to be an international winner. I just knew. It was like the bells went off in my head. And I said, we've got to be a part of this. We've got to be a part of this. And that was, I think, instinct brought that in. And then there's the other side of things where I could sit and watch a show in the West End or in New York and go, oh, God, I'm not enjoying this. I really don't like it. But the audience around me are absolutely loving it. And you've got to step outside of your own taste, because I produced a lot of shows that, you know, I couldn't sit through again. I hated them. But the public love them. They're just not of my taste, that's all. But it doesn't mean I don't produce them, because I know the masses will absolutely love them. So I produce them. You've got to have that. You've got to stand back, because if you turned around and you produced everything that you liked, I think you wouldn't be in business for too long.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
You've got to like it. But, you know, there are times and opportunities that come and you go, I've just got to do this. But thank God I've only got to go to one opening night. You know, I don't have to watch it again.
I'm not going to make you name any of those shows.
You know them. You've worked on them. But it's sort of, yeah, that's important that you can stand back.
Yeah.
And enjoy
it. Find the audience. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you've touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to just kind of take you back to King and I, because it feels like that was the one that opened the doors internationally. So do you feel like that was the door opener for your international career, was the King and I?
Well, it's interesting, because for many years I didn't go to New York or London until about 1980, and that was my first trip. And I spoke to Ken Brodziak, who was one of the people I worked with, and he was retired by then. And he gave me three names of people that I should see in New York. And one was a lady called Bridget Ashenberg, who was an agent, a man called Biff Liff, Samuel Liff, he was an agent. He was at William Morris. And another lady called Elizabeth Martin, who was an agent, literary agent. And he said, every time you go and see them, even if you haven't got business or a reason to go, still go. So I kept that advice and kept those contacts up. And those contacts built and built and built. And eventually they came to me with ideas for shows. They even came to me with people that would say, we've just had a telex or a facsimile from or a letter from this person. Should I give them the rights to do this show? Can you tell me? I've never heard of them. So I'd write back and say, give us an honest appraisal of, they don't pay their bills, let alone their royalties. Don't touch them. And there were a few of those people that, you know, I did advise the Americans not to work with. And there are other people that I said just the opposite, you know. So they respected me and used my knowledge of Australia. They were great allies. They're all gone now. They're all passed away. They were great. And then, so over the years, when leading up to King and I had a big network of people there. But when King and I happened and I won the award, it just seemed to be a lot easier that, you know, people would take your call quicker. They would set up a meeting quicker, want to meet you. And because there not saying it's not that now, but here in Australia, in America, on Broadway in particular, it is treated as a very serious multi-billion dollar business now, the art of Broadway shows, musicals and plays, and as it is in the UK. And we're here, you don't go to Australia to see a musical. You come and see the Kangaroos and whatever else you see here. But you do go to Broadway to see a musical. You go to New York to do business or shopping or whatever, but invariably you'll go and see a show.
Then after King and I opened in London in 2000, and I find this quite amazing actually, they did a This Is Your Life at that time when you were so young. Can I ask how old you were when they did it?
Oh, I wasn't that young. I was like, you know, I've got a big significant birthday next year, so I would have been, what, 40?
Maybe nearly 50, but still young to have someone reflect on your life and career. What do you remember of them doing it?
No idea it was going to happen, and it ended up being an hour show because there were so many people they wanted to put on it, like names that wanted to appear on it. I just remember the curtain calls happening for the opening night at the Palladium, and then I was coming down the stairs ready to go to the pub, backstage, to dash backstage to see the cast, and they did the sting, as they call it, and Big Red Book and Mike Munro shoved under my nose. And then we actually filmed it the next day. So they did the surprise that night, and then the next day we all had to redress the continuity in our dinner suits and go into studio at Teddington Studios, and they did an hour special. So, you know, everybody that I'd worked with was there or videotaped or whatever. So,
and you had no idea?
No idea. And I'm usually quite good, like springing things like that, thinking, oh, here we go. But I had absolutely no idea. It was great. And I went, oh, God. But of course, you, again, it's about you. So it's the ego. Right? Everybody talking about you, saying how wonderful you are. Little do they know. But, you know.
Now, this is like choosing your favourite child, and we've already talked about your beloved musicals. But if you had to pick one, what would you choose?
It's a really hard question because, as I said before, there's the three. There is King and I, My Fair Lady, and firstly, the King and I and My Fair Lady come out of my childhood. So, you know, King and I remember seeing at the back of a car in a drive-in movie cinema, probably in the 50s when I was like 4 years old or 5 years old, what I can remember of it. And then My Fair Lady, I remember seeing the movie in the 60s, 65, 66, in glorious 70mm. And I loved them so much. And I remember my mother telling me that she went to Melbourne to see the original stage production with Bunty Turner and Robin Bailey at Her Majesty's Theatre in 1959, which was like the first time that theatres, My Fair Lady originally was like The Phantom of the Opera or Hamilton now. It was such a groundbreaking piece of theatre. And it was that thing where you actually travelled in the state to go and see it, because it was going to take years before it got ever got to Adelaide or New Zealand or wherever. Yeah. So what J.C. Williamson's did, that they rebuilt the set and costumes and recast a whole new ensemble and other roles and brought out artists from London to play Henry Higgins and that. So they had, what they did is they, on a Saturday night, they had the original Bunty Turner and Robin Bailey close the show in Melbourne, and they flew to Sydney to appear in this new production, you know, the duplicate production, and the new principals went into Melbourne. So they had two companies, one in Sydney and one in Melbourne. Now, these are multi, now they'd be multi-million dollar productions, but in those days, I think they cost about $300,000 to put on, which was a pot of money. But the demand was so great. And then eventually one of the companies went to New Zealand and South Africa, toured to South Africa, and the other company toured the rest of Australia. And it went on for, I think, 5 or 7 years, those two companies of Fair Lady with, you know, Australian companies. It was such a success.
Yeah. You wouldn't hear of that now, would you, having the same show in two cities?
Yeah, unbelievable. They did it again years later with Godspell, the musical.
Oh, yeah.
Where one played Melbourne and one played Sydney, they duplicated it, but that's the only other time. But Fair Lady for its time was phenomenal.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'm not going to make you pick out of those three. They're all really special.
Yeah. I think Secret Garden has a lot of heart and has a lot to say, and I think that is probably emotionally my most favourite piece of musical theatre, where the other two are just, they are magnificent and they are grand and they're spectacular. And I would hate to think that the day will come where we cannot afford to produce those sort of pieces anymore, because they are beautifully constructed musicals with great stories. And there's always certain levels that you can take them on. And I think that Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe, that they were masters in constructing, you know, the great golden era of musicals. And, you know, that's why I continue to do them, and that because I love them. And I know I shouldn't do that, but I have not lost money out of one of them yet. So they're worth doing. And I want, you know, future generations to appreciate them.
I think that's it though, isn't it? Why do we have musicals today like Mormon and Hamilton? It's because of those masterpieces. You have to know your past to know your future, right? The beauty of those shows you mentioned is that they're timeless. You can bring them back and a new generation does get to experience the Fair Ladies and the Secret Gardens. It's just wonderful. Now let's just stay in the past for just a little bit longer, because I'm interested in what I think is called the GFO collection or the GFO holdings. You have so many things you've collected over your career, and I believe you've donated over 30 boxes of archives to the Art Centre Melbourne. What's your vision for that collection?
Well, there were things like, you know, because now everything is sort of digitized, that, you know, it's not put on paper. So I sent a lot of our paper files and that down to Melbourne to be kept, and I sent a lot of costumes down, and they have, you know, things from, you know, all the past musicals, you know, the leading ladies or leading men's costumes, all their Jill Perryman's Hello Dolly frock, red frock, They've got stuff from Secret Garden. Goodness knows what else they've got. I can't remember now. But I thought I don't want them sitting in a warehouse rotting away, you know. So that they have things. And every now and then they bring out and they do a big sort of display of them and all that. So in years to come, people can go through the stuff and look at it and go, oh, that's how they did that or they did this. Mm-hmm. Now, that goes way back to when I was putting My Fair Lady together. There was no record of definitive record of that original production of 1956, the Broadway production, which was recreated by Williamson's in 59. So I had to batch it all together from the archives at the Arts Centre in Melbourne, from the Australian version, from Canberra, from New York, and I think somewhere in the middle of America, a big university. We had people trolling all of these to get the original ground plans and the set designs, the costume designs, all that, to put it all together. So now My Fair Lady, if anybody wanted to do a production of that original production down to the last coloured palette for, you know, the staircase or the last coloured sequin on the ball gown, it's all documented out, all in one big box at the Art Centre in Melbourne, which I'm really happy with. That's great. And so I've set a whole lot of stuff down. So, you know, hopefully years to come when I'm gone, there'll be a John Frost that says, I want to do John Frost's production of Hello, Dolly, or I want to do whatever, whatever, and recreate that. That's all there. So that was that's the only reason I did that, because I didn't want it all lost and wasted.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we don't deal with paper anymore, so you can't feel it and touch it.
And am I right in saying that some of the gaps that needed to be filled on My Fair Lady, Julie filled with her memory of doing the show all those years ago? She remembered parts of it?
She was the last DNA of that production. They're all gone, even down to the assistant stage managers and the stage managers. They're all dead, you know. And so there was no one that we could go to and say, how did that revolve turn? What was the speed of that revolve? How did Eliza wear a cape in that scene, or didn't she not? So it was all that, which I loved. That was the best part of putting My Fair Lady together, and also picking Julie's brain, to what she remembered. And she said, you've got to remember, I was on stage. I never saw it from the front. So I could only tell you what I could see them doing next to me if they were on stage. I don't know what was happening behind me.
She knew half the choreography from Ascot.
Yeah, that's right. So it was, but she certainly added the flavour to it. And she was in the rehearsal room, you know, from, you know, 9 in the morning until 7 at night, without a doubt, at her age. And she had assistants and all that, yes, but she put in the time, the research and the hours to do it, to what we created.
Oh, yeah.
Which sort of leads to the thing, it's all in storage. And all, you know, I've got a massive warehouse at Goulburn where all our shows are stored, all the costumes way back to Big River, not necessarily full sets, but I have them. I've kept everything. You know, down to Secret Garden, down to, you know, King and I, South Pacific. Oh, that's all there. Hello, Dolly. All I've got 3 sets of Sound of Music. I think of different productions. I think I've got 4 sets of Grease. I want to do Grease. You know, so it's an Annie there, which we'll do again in a few years' time, and it all comes out. So, and it's all the costumes are all stored in air-conditioned, vacuum-sealed building, so, you know, mould doesn't grow on them and all of that. All of Wicked is there, all the shows.
Yeah, so, oh, that's okay. So cool. Let's jump into the current now. We've had COVID hanging over our heads, but as we're recording this, we can really see the light at the end of the tunnel. What is your take on the longer term impacts on our industry, given what we've experienced for the last 18 months to 2 years?
Well, it's given me a taste of what retirement's like, and I'm here to tell you I don't like it. So I can't wait to get back. So I think overall, I think the industry will bounce back because they'll be hungry for it. I think at this very minute as we're talking about this, I don't think they're rushing back in their droves at present, because I think we're more worried about getting a haircut and going to have dinner at a restaurant. I think that's people's priorities. Who wants to go and sit in the theatre? But I think that will come back, and I certainly hope it will come back for when we do 9 to 5 in February and Cinderella in May, June next year. It'll come back with a fury. But at present, it's tough out there because you're living on your wits, and you talk to any other producer, they really don't know if they've got a show on tonight or tomorrow night, let alone in 2 months' time. But hopefully we're through the worst of it. And I think that what they've done in opening the gates as such, I think it's a good thing. I think we've got to learn to live with this thing. It's never going to go away, but we just got to, live with it and move on. And hopefully within the next couple of years, they'll all give us a pill to take and we won't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
So it'll be fine.
And given we've talked about Broadway and West End a little bit, and they've had their own lockdowns, and given that a lot of new work comes out of there, what is your take on, say, if we go forward 2 to 3 years when we'd ordinarily see the pipeline coming through from out there, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, look, I think what's going to happen is that, all the, the current, the Visit Victorias and Destination Sydney, they're all looking for the next Hamilton or Book of Mormon. Well, I'm here to tell you folks, it ain't there. There is no big shows coming over the hill in the next 3 to 4 years. They're not. Now, let's say the next big show, I predict that's going to be big, will be, what's it called? It's just opened at the Adelphi Theatre in London. About the flying car, Time Machine.
Oh, Back to the Future.
Back to the Future. That is a massive crowd pleaser. I think that's going to be the next blockbuster or semi-blockbuster to come out. But other than that, there's nothing. So I think we're going to see the next 3 years at least, maybe more, of revivals or shows that are shows, but there will be no more Hamiltons for a while. Mm-hmm. Now, in saying that, I'm sitting down writing the next Hamilton Book of Mormon as I speak. So let's hope they find a home for it and a producer that can exploit it internationally. These things don't all the time. So, in the meantime, I think we need to nurture what we've got and encourage audiences to come back. I think people do want to have a good time when they go out. They want to leave their troubles at home. So I don't think it needs to be too heavy. But I think it's good. They've got to be strong books, great scores, and, I've got the next 4 years planned out what I'm doing, so I'm not particularly worried. And everything I do, as you know, is popularist, so they're all crowd-pleaser stuff that I'm going to do or revive, but you're always on the lookout for the next show.
Sounds like it's time to dust off those costumes at Goulburn with some of the shows you've got hidden away up there.
Definitely Annie will come back, Greece will come back. So, yeah, it's going to be fun.
That is just going to be so much fun. Now, you've talked about the sale to Crossroad Live. Tell us a bit about the benefits of teaming up with that company and how that's all working on a global scale now.
Okay, the purchase of Gordon Frost to Crossroads live, I think it's been fantastic because what it means now for me is that I only need to go to one source of raising money for my shows, which is Crossroads Live. We are a company that has that also owns David Ian Productions in the West End. We own Michael Harrison's Kudos Pantomimes. We also own, well, we don't own, we have creative affiliations and business affiliations with Tremendous Entertainment in Singapore, and we have affiliations in the Philippines now with theatre producers there. We have production deals with certain directors and creators of new works in England and in America. So let's say a show comes up and it's the life story of John Frost, and we go, that's a great idea, that's a great musical, but the owners of that musical want a big chunk of money to be a part of it. So what we do is we now invest in the original production, which automatically gives us the rights to the UK and Australia. So it puts us in a really strong position to get the rights to do those shows here and in Asia if we want them, and in the West End for that matter. So where in the old days I'd have to, you know, scrape the money together and get on a plane and go over, now it can be done very easily. It's put us in, you know, and we've got some stuff coming up in the future over the next 3 years that haven't opened yet in New York, which I feel really good about it. I think that we'll push the company further along. So it's just made life a lot easier. And because I've worked with David Ian a lot, and they've acquired David's company, we can do a lot more co-productions in the future, which we intend to do. So it's good.
It sounds great. It sounds like the upshot is more product coming through, which means more of our theatres are full, which means more work for our artists and crews and administrators and everyone in the industry.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and we're not just here to do stuff from London or in New York and that. If we see something that is coming out of Australia or New Zealand, anywhere that we feel has legs and commercial legs, we would get behind it and co-fund it or fund it and pursue it. And I've got a couple of new Australian works in the mix that we're looking at, which I think will have big potential in the future if they get off the ground and that. But these things, new musicals always take a time.
Well, that's exciting. It sounds like there's a lot coming through. Now, we do like to end the podcast with a couple of quick fire questions, and we like to start by asking everybody, why does arts matter for you?
Why do the arts matter to me?
Yeah.
Well, I think they matter because I think they bring people together, and I think it's a great appreciation of the better things in life. And, you know, to go to an art gallery and see a beautiful painting or exhibition is just a joy. And to, you know, go to the ballet or the opera or the drama theatre to see, you know, a great classic performed, it's a joy. What a miserable world we'd be if we didn't have these wonderful things to look at and appreciate and that. And I just think it people that don't, you know, that think probably what I'm talking about is rubbish, I feel sorry for them in a way, because without any of that, and we've just seen the last 18 months, 20 months, with all that been taken away from us, the effect it has on us, you know, it makes the life a lot duller. No different to, you know, the horse racing or a great football game. You take that away and people go stir crazy. You know, they need that sort of stimulation. And I think the arts has exactly the same thing as a great grand final or a great football match or a cricket match, you know.
Yeah, I could not agree more. Well, maybe not with the cricket bit. I don't think anyone listens to this podcast that doesn't understand and appreciate the value and the joy of the arts. We're just so lucky. We've talked so much about your career and how inspiring it is with all that you've achieved. What's something you wish you'd known when you began that you know now?
Nothing. I wouldn't want to do it any other way, because everything that I know now, I've had to learn. And you've got to go through those things. You've got to go through all of those, jump all those puddles.
Yeah, great answer.
Yeah, and I think that I've been blessed that everything that I've wanted to do, I've done. And if you said to me, oh, there's got to be something else you want to achieve, I can't think of it. I can't think of what I want to do now. Just continue doing what I'm, you know, and making people happy and hopefully making a lot of money for me and you know, keeping one's health. I think that's important, and entertaining people. I love entertaining people. You know, I suppose I am the Woolworths of theatre producers. I do things because I want my audiences to have a great time. That's the worst thing. The thing about the theatre too is you can sit and go and see something and think, well, there's two hours of my life wasted. And so people say to me, why don't you go to the theatre as much as you do? I think, because I don't want to, you know, there's other things I can do. You know, I don't want to sit through 2 hours of rubbish. I find it frustrating. But, you know, I've just contradicted myself by saying all of that.
Well, not really, because I do remember sitting in a meeting with you not that long ago talking to you about a social strategy, and you said, I'm really not that interested. I just want to put shows on the stage and entertain people. So you know what you want. It's in you and you do it really well. And Australian audiences have benefited from it for so many years. So keep doing it, John. You're bringing people joy.
Thank you. Because you go into it. I just do shows. I could be, you know, sitting on a building cars or something. You know, that's what I do. So it's not anything different for me. That's all I could do. The scary thing is if I couldn't do them anymore, what would happen? You know, if all of a sudden they closed all the theatres down, which exactly they've done in the last 18, 20 months. And that was scary, because it's like, I can't do anything else. I'll have to mow lawns.
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that, as I can't imagine you mowing a lawn. Oh, it's just been so nice to chat with you, John. And it's really nice to bottle up your amazing experiences and amazing career. And as I said, it is bringing joy to a lot of people. Sounds like you've got lots of great shows coming through for people to come and see. And we've just got to get people back to their theatre. So it's great you're there, still producing, still bringing us great product for our stages. So thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Lyndall. It's been a pleasure.